Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me is returning host, Jane Dempsey.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Jane. Could you tell the audience out there a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I am a Chicago resident. I'm a big book lover, film lover. And I am happy to be here talking about my favorite book.
Well, this is Jane's favorite book is Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, which I had not read since the early 90s. And I was very happy to be able to return to this book. Jane, you want to talk a little bit about your history with this book?
Sure. So it was assigned reading for me in school. It was assigned the summer before my senior year. And up until that point, for a quick background, I am half black, half white, went to a predominantly white high school. It was not fun to read the sort of token African-American books, definitely in class. I was on Sophomore Lit last year talking about Their Eyes Were Watching God and how it was very awkward to have to be taught African-American vernacular in class by a teacher who could not care less. So with this summer assignment, this was the first African-American and just overall book that completely floored me. And even though it's, 400, 500 pages or something?
Yeah, about 500.
500. I probably read it within like 3 weeks. The second book was Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart, which I sadly read like in a day because the next day was school. But I know we'll get into the plot later, but it completely changed my life.
This was not a book I read in high school. As I've mentioned before, I come from the whitest high school in the whitest town in America. And sadly, I didn't read it until I got to college, where it was part of my freshman humanities core. But it wasn't really, I think, until I read it in grad school as part of a course on early 20th century modernist literature that it really stuck with me. I read it at the tail end of a bunch of Harlem Renaissance writers. Now, Ellison was a little bit late to be considered part of the Harlem Renaissance, but he certainly hung with a lot of the Harlem Renaissance luminaries. This book, by the way, was a Book of the Month Club book, so it was an enormous bestseller for Ellison. Sadly, his only novel.
Yeah.
But if you write one like this, I guess you get to sit back for the rest of your life.
Not his fault that his house caught on fire and destroying a good chunk of Juneteenth.
Yeah. As Jane mentions, he lost a lot of his manuscript, and it gives you pause to think about in these days where whenever you write something, you know, there's a good chance that it will be backed up not only on your computer, but your local flash drive. And if you're smart, on some sort of an off-site service. This is back in the time where you had one copy of your manuscript. Okay, so I'm going to give the barest of introductions to the plot of this book. Anyone who's read this book knows it is crazy, jam-packed with everything that was happening in America in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. And I apologize ahead of time because I'm probably going to leave out your favorite character or your favorite scene, but here goes. Invisible Man starts with our narrator, who's never given a name, living underground, literally, in an abandoned basement that's lit by 1,369 light bulbs fueled on stolen power. He tells us that he's invisible because people don't see him. And apparently, this isn't a metaphor, or maybe it is. He tells stories of people actually not seeing him. And this slipperiness between what is metaphor and symbol on the one hand and what is the literal action of the novel is just all through this novel, so you better get used to it. He goes back to tell us when he was a teenager living in the South. He got a scholarship to go to an all-black college. However, his benefactors, the town's white elite, their largesse came with the price of him having to fight in the so-called Battle Royale, where he and several other black youths were blindfolded and made to fistfight. In spite of all this, he goes to school. In his junior year, he makes the mistake of driving a rich white trustee through the poor black quarters of town, and it causes the trustee to freak out. It also causes the president of the college to freak out, and he is forced to go to New York City to work at a paint factory, the paint factory where they make the whitest paint in America by using the blackest ingredients. Again, both a metaphor and what actually happens in the story. However, the factory blows up and he finds himself living in Harlem with a kindly Southern landlady who takes him in. He's also taken in by the Brotherhood, a group of politically minded people who are this book's stand-in for the Communist Party. Our narrator catches the eye of one brother, Jack. Jack likes the fact that the narrator can speak to the black population of Harlem. On the other hand, he discourages the narrator from embracing his black identity, going so far as to give the narrator a new name, which we also never learn. Later, the narrator and his new friend, who's the youth leader, Todd Clifton, are speaking at rallies in Harlem to counteract the influence of Ross the Exhorter, who is a black nationalist preaching separatism. The narrator gets a lot of enemies within the Brotherhood who think that he is guilty of self-promotion, and he is assigned the job of taking on what Brother Jack calls the woman problem. He gets moved to a different, richer, whiter part of New York, where he ends up being the plaything of bored housewives. Back in Harlem, things are falling apart. Ross, the exhorter, is becoming more popular, and Clifton has disappeared. The narrator is called back. He finds Clifton on the street selling Sambo dolls, and in a raid on the sales by the police, Clifton is shot and killed. Things are starting to get very ugly in Harlem after this. There are riots in the street. Our narrator speaks at a remembrance of Clifton, and the Brotherhood finally decides that he's too much of a liability. The Brotherhood has decided that they want to pull out of Harlem. The narrator has to escape an altercation with Ross the Exhorter by putting on a pair of sunglasses, which causes everyone in Harlem to mistake the narrator for this mysterious character, Reinhardt, who is either a bookie or a pimp, or maybe he's a reverend. By the end of the book, the narrator is trying to maneuver himself into finding out what is actually going on with the Brotherhood. He attempts to seduce the wife of one of the Brotherhood named Sybil, but Sybil is really only interested in the narrator because of her desire to play racist sex games with him. At the very end of the book, Ross the Exhorter, now self-styled as Ross the Destroyer, appears in the street dressed as an Abyssinian warlord. He throws a spear at the narrator, who throws the spear right back at him, and runs off from the crowds, also from the police, who don't believe that his suitcase actually belongs to him, and falls into a manhole, where he ends up underground, and he decides to stay. But by the book's end, it turns out the narrator has let us know it's time for him to come out of hibernation. It is a 500-page book, 563 pages in my edition, And I'm sure I've left out everything that, Jane, you want to talk about.
Well, his Reinhardt cosplay actually also involved a hat and sunglasses. oh, man. Clearly, you guys can see why this is my favorite book. Anything you want me to ask, say anything that you left out? I feel like you...
I just want to let's just talk a little bit about this book. Mm-hmm. and how it works, because it's an incredible book. As I mentioned, one of the things that really struck me reading it through this time are the number of times Ellison throws out something that's an obvious symbol, mm-hmm. but it's also the actual physical reality of this book. And it's a funny game that he's playing with the reader. There's also dreams that come up. There are drug-induced hallucinations that come up.
Right.
And you have to pick apart what's the reality of this fiction.
No, yeah, absolutely. Even, like you said, the drug-induced hallucinations, after his quick foray in the paint factory, after, you know, being chased out of it by his boss for a day, who loathes him, he then, you know, basically gets taken into shock therapy by a bunch of doctors. A very kind of a trippy scene where he can only hear... a bunch of doctors sort of talking about him, and almost like a little like nink and a wink and a nod to scientific racism. I believe that they mentioned stuff like, oh, we've never like really worked on a specimen of his structure, or things like that. And then that kind of charges him out into the world. And yeah, I mean, so much is pretty fantastical, even as you described it. A part of me, like, just to describe it as bare bones, it's, their Mozart is really funny. Reinhardt, hysterical. Or just what you hear of Reinhardt and people around him. But something about the way Ellison writes and the character's perspective, it never feels farcical. The sort of mixture of metaphor and symbols and heightened language and moments, to me, it wasn't like I was, you know, reading a farce or a satire. It felt like a visceral punch about being Black in America and that, you know, being used and manipulated and having to brush up against other people's own perceived realities and not really being able to form your own and never quite feeling like the stable ground to make your own reality.
Yeah, that's all. The other thing that I think about this is Ellison sets up the rules of this universe very early on in the introduction, by first of all having this absurd situation of a man living underground in a room lit with thousands of light bulbs, that first of all he's saying it's going to be a kind of a crazy trip, but he's also playing little games. He starts at the beginning with a hallucination the narrator has while listening to Louis Armstrong and smoking marijuana and fantasizing about a sermon of a preacher. And as you were discussing before we began, this is a kind of a reference to the opening of Moby Dick, which also opens with a sermon. And if Moby Dick is about the whiteness of the pure whiteness of the whale, the preacher in this sermon is talking about the blackness of blackness. And that's a very literate game to be playing. But I think Ellison from the beginning wants to say, look, I can play your game and I can bring in as many high culture references as you like, and I will. But he's also, from the very beginning, acknowledging jazz it's interesting that he brings up Louis Armstrong, because Louis Armstrong was one of the first African-American artists to really cross over into complete popularity amongst both blacks and whites in America. Ellison himself trained as a jazz musician, and I think that he's also trying to give a nod to that part of his creativity and his psyche, and the way that he's going to be improvising on themes. And there is this kind of an improvisatory approach that this book has. It's very picaresque. It goes from scene to scene to scene, and each of these scenes could go into another novel.
No, yeah, absolutely. And the choice of the one Louis Armstrong song that he listens to in the prologue, "What Did I Do to Get So Black and Blue?" He references the jazz later on in the novel too, but in the prologue, he sort of states that he really idolizes the jazz musicians for kind of standing in their own pain, in their blackness, and trying to... Ellison just makes so many references about whether it's time or the lack of time and the own narrators feel like in history, and just sort of saying that the jazz artist is often talking about being both in and out of history at the same time, and sort of knowing that they are invisible, but singing and yelling and letting out something anyway, which I definitely gets mentioned throughout. And I was going to say, also we were talking about the sort of literary references to other things. I know we had mentioned earlier this week, because I was often Facebook messaging John my thoughts because I was too excited rereading it. Is this book not all True Blood's fault? I kept on thinking. And the grandfather, in a way. Not the grandfather, but kind of True Blood. But, like you said, when going to those former slave quarters where Mr. Norton, that very rich elderly white man, Mr. Norton kind of prods True Blood to kind of say, hey, what's going on? And True Blood, being a very poor, beleaguered farmer, starts talking his lurid tale about how he, impregnated both his wife and daughter while asleep. And it's a very, very long chapter where True Blood explains the whole, despicable situation. And it's sort of like Ellison kind of nodding to how transfixed white America was at either the saddest, most despicable kind of story like that relating to black people, and then kind of that pity fueling Mr. Norton to be very patronizing towards the black community as a donor.
That's a good point you bring up. The book moves from the South to the North, and the other thing that it's encapsulating here, of course, is the Great Migration, mm-hmm. which was well underway at this point in history, but it only spends a very short time in the small town that the narrator grows up in, and in dealing with race relations, Ellison isn't as interested, I think, in dealing with the blatant racism of the town he grew up in. He's much more interested in the subtleties of the relationships between the narrator and whites who think of themselves as well-meaning, who think of themselves as having the interests of people of color at heart, who turn out to be much more slippery and dangerous and distressing. People like Mr. Norton, who needs to impose a narrative onto the people that he's helping. He needs to be in that position of beneficence. And as you say, he's both appalled but also fascinated by the story of True Blood. And True Blood himself talks about how all these white people around the neighborhood want to come around and point to him and ask him. It's this desire to point to what they think of as the otherness and the I don't know what to say the
Like the soap opera. Or not even soap opera, like, what's the... I forgot the little, like, phrase or the famous thing, but kind of to segue, when you're still in the South, you know, you kind of hear... You go to the church, and Ellison does take a bit of time kind of talking about how, you know, it's the black church at this black college, but they're still enshrouded in the symbols of their oppressors, which is a quote that he references, and Reverend Barbie, who I had forgotten before, which is, I mean, this book is, there's so much going on, and like, I looked down, and I was like, right, there was that reverend, but his whole speech describing the founder of the college, where the other kind of seductive story about the black experience of white America often seems is that Horatio Alger story of rags to riches, you know, this black person knew their place, which is the emphasis in this narrative, but still, you know, worked really hard. I think in this modern context, we would call it bootstrapping, and, you know, worked as hard as they could be to then go on and start this college.
Ellison himself went to the Tuskegee Institute, mm-hmm. which was founded by Booker T. Washington. And Booker T. Washington had this idea that what was going to be good for Black America was going to be, you don't get involved in politics, you don't get involved in culture. What you do is you learn a good trade, you make your economic way through the world, and you try your best not to offend any white people, and that's the way that the Black race would rise in America. Now, I mean, obviously, it's the narrator can't live in that world, but it's interesting that Ellison himself, you know, went to a school very like this school.
Right.
He was dealing with ideas very like the ideas of the school.
Here I am getting stuck. I'm just stuck talking about the South when it's like a third of this book, not less, a quarter. But with his the head of the dean of the school, Dr. Bledsoe, he's, you know, so kindly and, you know, always very gracious and humble around the white people. I think that he takes like a very, like he sits, even though he's the head of the school, he doesn't sit with the white people at this sermon. Like he's very, very obsequious to them. And even after the whole True Blood incident where Mr. Norton more or less is like, it's fine. You never know what behind the scenes Mr. Norton really like said or did, but he seems very kind of like white guy oblivious, and Mr. Bledsoe loses his shit and is like to the narrator, like, you are the worst. Like you know, you're in the way of our great black American dream. Hence, you gotta go.
It's fascinating to me that Bledsoe echoes what the narrator's grandfather said at the beginning of the book. The grandfather on his deathbed tells the narrator that the way to deal with whites is to kill them with kindness, mm-hmm. to destroy them with yeses. The idea that you're going to present a very subservient attitude to the world, but you're actually going to be undermining them from within and his grandfather, of course, is completely uneducated and was born into slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Bledsoe, as an educated black man at the time, has exactly the same attitude about white America too. That's the way, because his problem he has with the narrator is that the narrator did what Mr. Norton asked him to do. He said, "What you should have done was direct him somewhere else. You could have come up with any number of lies to tell him that would not have taken him into the slums. You could have done any number of things, and you don't actually do what whites want you to do. You act as though you're going to do what whites want you to do."
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, we can move up north because I mean, yeah. And even, you know, it's great because obviously the South is more blatant than the North, but still you do have that entanglement of their idea of progress mixed with staying in your place. And I know when the narrator first goes to Harlem, there's a scene where he's, you know, he's like shocked because like there's like a black traffic operator in the middle of Harlem and like white cars are following him and like things like that blow his mind. And I know Yeah, and even he, I had actually forgotten how young the narrator was. I was like 17 when I read this book, and now it's a decade later. And so his naivete is, it does make more sense, I guess, now that I am nearly 27.
The one line that stuck with me when he first comes to Harlem is he said he had never seen black people be angry in public before.
Right, yeah.
And that's such an amazing line. Now, when he gets to the North, one of the things he finds, he's been told by the by Dr. Bledsoe that he's just going to New York to pay for his tuition sort of as recompense for what he's done. And he's carrying with him letters of recommendation, which turn out to be sort of Bellerophonic letters.
Mm-hmm.
Again, he's making, Ellison is making a kind of a classical allusion here. In the Greek myth of Bellerophon, who killed the Chimera, he was given a letter that he had to carry with him because the king wanted to kill him, but he didn't dare invoke the wrath of the gods by killing his guests. So he sent Bellerophon on to someone else with a letter saying, please kill this person for me. But he thought that it was a letter that that was like a letter of introduction. And similarly, the narrator is given a set of sealed letters that say, this guy screwed up, he's expelled, but he doesn't know it. Just, you know, keep him busy.
Another funny allusion, the white guy that breaks it to him, you know, is the son of this Mr. Emerson. And even Mr. Norton back in the South had been like, have you read Emerson or Thoreau? I'm pretty sure it was Emerson.
It was Emerson.
It was Emerson, right. I was like, oh, don't make it be Thoreau. But and he was like, yes, self-reliance, of course, this, this, and that. And then it's just funny that then the son of Emerson, who does have him read that letter, it's sort of this weird, like, the son is like trying to help him and be sympathetic, but is too, I guess, navel-gazy to actually then do anything to help him.
Ralph Ellison himself was named after Ralph Waldo Emerson,
yeah,
by his father. So one of the things that I have enormous admiration for in this book is the way that he deals with all these literary figures that white America would know. But he's not really interested in telling a story that is in any way mitigated for his white readers. I find it kind of frustrating when I look at the back of this book and I find, you know, I know that his great supporters at the time were people like Robert Penn Warren, who he was friends with, and there's a lot of the contemporary critics were sort of trying to sell this book to white America by saying, oh, there are universal themes in this book. But I feel like, why not read a book about, you know, African-Americans for once? You know, you've got plenty of books here about white. Why does everything have to be universal?
Yeah, I think that I have the same edition. I read it on Kindle/audiobook this time, and I'm pretty sure, right, I've forgotten that was what they were saying, because I can't see how you would get that from this book. Like, the whole brotherhood, which, like you said, is Ellison was directly disillusioned by the Communist Party of the 50s, is so duplicitous. And like, even in the very beginning, when you meet Brother Jack, the white redheaded man who, you know, hears the narrator speechify. I mean, all I could think of was like, what is that, economist Malthus? Like, he was just talking about resources and, you know, being scientific and using things like the activism and the social change to like such a zero sum game. Like,
yeah.
I mean, as a 16-year-old, I hadn't seen him to be a snake so early on, maybe because obviously I'm rereading it. But just, I guess, yeah, with that dramatic irony, when you are first introduced to Brother Jack, I'm like, oh my God, go away.
Yeah. Well, Jack, from the beginning, when the narrator talks about what the Brotherhood can bring, what kind of uplift the Brotherhood can bring to the African-American community in New York, Jack's immediate response is, why is everything about race with you people?
Yeah.
And it's such a great line, because again, it's that you people, the alleged liberal white who says he doesn't see race because honestly all he sees is whiteness, you know.
Right.
Ellison was encouraged in writing this by Richard Wright, who he became friends with. Richard Wright encouraged him to write this. Wright also was involved with communism, didn't have quite the same kind of quick fallout with communism, but he did have a rough time with communism too. I can't help but feel that a lot of this book is in some ways a response to Native Son, because Native Son was in sort of the naturalist tradition, which is the tradition that you think of with books like McTeague and Sister Carrie, stories about people who are being inexorably drawn along by their situations, by their social state, and by the forces of society around them that usually bring about their destruction. And Native Son is about a black man who is a poor, unintelligent, uneducated character who commits terrible crimes and is eventually punished for them. And Invisible Man kind of refutes a lot of that, those expectations. Ellison is writing very cleverly and eloquently about a smart narrator. I mean, he's obviously a naive narrator who gets moved along and manipulated by people, but he's constantly reflecting on what's just happened to him and making decisions to not let the same thing happen again. While he's being buffeted by fate and he's moving from one scene to the next, he's also an equal participant, I think, in his own agency in this book.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the structure of the prologue is like where he's at now, and the majority of the book is flashback, him explaining his past, does help bring out how self-aware he is, self-aware to a fault, which is very relatable to me. And as you were talking about that, I mean, his self-awareness, I think that where he is now, and even as he describes how he's, where he's been, you know, he's been so forced upon by so many different people and used that he is now so overwhelmed to the point of being paralyzed. And he is self-aware even in the prologue by saying, like, I understand I'm shirking responsibility here, like, that's the point of my hibernation and being underground and invisible and things like that. And speaking of, I guess, other drawing comparisons, to bring it back to when I'd first read it in high school, it just makes me laugh because about 2 years prior in my all-white high school, this whole, you know, disillusioned, unreliable narrator in terms of, like, what's metaphor, what's real, 2 years prior, the majority of my high school English class adored Catcher in the Rye, as most, I think, white Americans do. And I just vitriolically hated Holden Caulfield. I just could not relate to him. I found him whiny. And then on the flip side, I do recall a lot of my classmates, when we read Invisible Man, to kind of be frustrated by his eventual inaction after everything that happened to him and his sort of just being disillusioned by one person after the other. And I was the one who was obsessed with him.
The other thing that's interesting to me as I was reading it this time was I was thinking about that. The narrator leaves us with the final lines of the book saying he's ready to come out and rejoin society again. And it's a fascinating bit of writing on Ellison's part, because he's leaving it open as to what his attitude is, whether he's going to kind of get out there and give it another go. On the other hand, he's been involved in sort of this petty sabotage of capitalism by draining the electricity to his room, and you're not sure whether that's what it means. The weird thing is he starts the book by talking about being invisible, and he gives an example of someone actually honestly not seeing him in the sense of he, the narrator, physically grabs this person by the lapels, and this person doesn't know what's happening to him, which seems so ridiculously over the top. And of course, through the better part of this book, he is not physically invisible. He's actually dealing with people. We end the book with him ready to join the world of the visible again. There's a part of me that likes to see this in terms of the burgeoning civil rights movement. It's just two more years out from here to the Alabama bus boycott and the beginnings of the 1950s civil rights movement. That may just be a weird coincidence here, you know. But if this book is in some way an encapsulation of the ways in which African Americans have sought inclusion or uplift in the 20th century, running from Booker T. Washington on the one hand to involvement in the Communist Party into Marcus Garvey's black nationalism on the other hand, I just can't help but kind of want to see it in a sort of a larger way. But the thing that's wonderful about the book is you don't have to take it that way. It can right. also just be about a particular person.
That's what I was about to say. I think that in a way, you know, it is called Invisible Man, One Man. And the big kind of general theme of this book, which could be about most, high school books, would be identity. And I mean, the narrator constantly is, you know, when you see him go throughout these different things, in the very beginning, maybe chapter two or three, he says that he never got a chance to form his identity. Certain other people's expectations were thrust on him. And you kind of see that throughout the book. And I think that that it's not only happening to him through the white people, but it's through, you know, anyone that is just so, I think he talks about the chaos of the world and how so many people become steadfast in these kind of cult religious-like things like the Brotherhood or the beliefs of Ross, the exhorter slash destroyer, you know, and like him doubling down on his absurdity in the narrator's words, kind of have ground them in the kind of chaos of the world. And the narrator is being kind of ping-ponged along by all these different people that expect him to be projections of what they have of reality. And I think that's what sends him into hibernation. I'm not sure if he's ever going to be any less emo. I'm not even being facetious, and kind of fit in anywhere, if we're to believe, you know, what's been going on within the five or however many years that the novel takes place. But yeah, I feel like that's how I felt as a high schooler. And now even as a adult, it just feels like, you know, a black man's identity and not being able to forge it on his own.
One of the things about forging his identity that just occurred to me as you were saying that is there are several passages in this book where he has to come to terms with himself as a Southerner living in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a scene where he buys yams from a street seller and eats them. And that seems sort of transgressive in a way to him, because it's an acknowledgement of having these country traditions
right.
that are very important to him. But they're also traditions that are sadly stereotypically black. And he's trying so hard in the Brotherhood to be sophisticated and sort of raceless to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this ability, these moments he has where he connects with who he is. There's an intersection between self and tradition that he hasn't quite negotiated. And part of the problem with that is that when being black, he also has all these expectations placed on him by others about what it means to be black, and he's trying not to give in to that, which makes it hard for him to authentically embrace those things that he actually values about
him. Yeah. And I do think, actually, the more I think about it, I don't know if, like, you know, after the epilogue, he just goes on to be a nameless dude selling yams. Because, like, in a way, I think he does have that, even from, you know, the speech before the Battle Royale throughout the book, he does have that, you know, some humans do clamor for a place in history. So that other recurring mention is just, you know, I want to be in history. Sometimes I'm out of history. And so joining the Brotherhood, I think that being like validated by these white Northerners and his idea of like being in history and success and progress is a very white space. And with the one character we haven't mentioned yet, Todd Clifton, who was the black man who has been in the Brotherhood longer than the narrator, you know, when he goes missing after the Brotherhood loses some steam, he was also a great orator and apparently, like, just so personable, and like the Brotherhood and the people of Harlem loved him. When he disappears, and the narrator then sees him months later selling those really racist blackfacey little Sambo dolls, like, out in the street, and you're right, he's the one who eventually gets shot by the police. And before he gets shot, and even after he gets shot, the narrator just muses, like, how could Todd, who was, like, in history, you know, within, I guess, in a sense, like, history is written by the winners, is kind of what the whole gist of those paragraphs are saying. How could it, someone who was so close to that kind of, like, fame and, like, always being historically known, choose to fall out of history and then just become this stereotype? And, I mean, the Sambo is straight up racist. It's not, like, a traditional yams moment. But still, yeah, I think that the narrator was very ambitious. You know, he wasn't just naive and trying to, like, do good. I think that he was trying to be seen and have a place in history.
To switch gears here a little bit, I do want to kind of bring up, to quote Brother Jack, the woman question.
Oh. one thing
about this book that struck me as I was reading through is it's a very male book. It's about a male character, and it's about a lot of issues about not simply being black, but being a black man. And the few women that are in this book are, I think, brought up specifically as mirrors to white ideas about black sexuality.
Yeah.
And It's interesting to me that at the beginning of the book, in the Battle Royale, there's a stripper who's brought out in front of the black teens who are about to fight to try and get them riled up into some sort of a frenzy, and it bespeaks all these really gross white ideas about black sexuality, particularly when it comes to black men and white women. And then, of course, that's bookended by the fact that once the narrator gets up to New York, the Brotherhood places him in a position where a lot of bored, unhappy white housewives want him to be their black fantasy. I'm curious, what did you think about this?
So the only female character I had remembered from reading it 10 years ago was Sybil, because she was so over the top. My class at the time, like, they thought she was hysterical. I also was like, she's crazy. And I, you know, it was stuff that you or loved as a child or teen. You wonder of, like, oh my gosh, like, is there going to be something crazy sexist here that I just can't abide by? So yeah, at the same time, you know, I don't think that Ralph Ellison, like, missed his calling to, like, host Lilith Fair. Like, I don't think he's, like, a feminist icon, like, whatever. Well, no, I mean, yeah. So what I think is that there's not a lot of black women in the novel, though one that really got any time to speak or anything like that was Mary, the landlord that he stays with for a bit. And so there are a lot of, I mean, he's like explicitly will use, he even says kind of after his breakdown and kind of like, okay, I'm an invisible man now moment, and tries to undermine the Brotherhood. He's like, I will use women. They're women as pawns now. And so there's that. And even before then, he thought that they would often used these white women weaponized towards them, like the Brotherhood white men. He was like, and like, so before Sybil, there was like another, white bored housewife that he had just wanted to talk to, or she wanted to talk to him after the women question speech. And then he was like, oh, is this one of those things that, you know, the white man is like using his white wife as like as bait, and then like, I'm going to get hurt. And I think that's, obviously, it's not great to have women as bait, as seductresses, as, you know, adult nymphomaniacs, as Sybil purports to be. At the same time, I think, you know, a lot of that, his anxiety about the white woman as like alluring bait, is like that Southern black male fear of, you know, Emmett Till and things like, if I even like look at a white woman funny, I'll get lynched type of thing. So there's that paranoia. He does get emboldened in the North, as he does sleep with that one white wife. And I think both her and Sybil, like you said, like he's using them as pawns in a way, especially Sybil. But then right back at them, especially Sybil, is just so fetishizing him. Like, Sybil is so over the top with telling him that, like, as a little girl, she heard, you know, like a Mandingo rape of a white woman story, and it totally turned her on. Will you do that to me? Like, I believe that there are people like this, and like, it's astonishing.
It falls into a larger category of scenes in the book where ostensibly people who are ostensibly his allies are curious about him qua black man. There's like the some of the Brotherhood want him to sing spirituals at one point. Mm-hmm. You know, all the cliches of white people, the white people have about blacks, and the desire for black people to perform their culture for white people's amusement. In this case, you know, white women's sexual amusement. I guess I don't fault Ellison for this. I think it's a very, very big book and has a lot of stuff in it. And I don't fault him for necessarily not having more sympathetic female characters. Mary is, I think, a very sympathetic character, and she's the one who I think more than anyone else in the book suggests to the narrator that he might find something in his own past that he might value, that he doesn't need to throw that all away simply because he's now in the North and because he's now giving speeches for the Brotherhood.
Yeah, definitely. This is, like you said, a very large book, so who knows if Ellison could have thrown more at us. No really white character is redeemable, so I'm not sure if, like, making the white woman more sympathetic was the move. Could there have been more black women? To me, yes. I would love if anyone knows any books written by black women, starring black women, that are much in the same vein as Invisible Man, please sign me up. But yeah, like I said, and in a way, I mean, it's not surprising. And I think that a lot of the black feminism that came out even after the civil rights movement was critiquing how a lot of the pro-black sentiment was like about being a black man and like this, it's me. Kind of selfishness.
So let's finish here by talking a little bit about the style. And this time, let's look at the famous opening lines here that Jane, you're going to read for us.
I am an invisible man. No, I'm not a spook like those who haunted Edgar Allan Poe. Nor am I one of your Hollywood movie ectoplasms. I am a man of substance, of flesh and bone, fiber and liquids, and I might even be said to possess a mind. I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me. Like the bodiless heads you see sometimes in circus sideshows, it is as though I have been surrounded by mirrors of hard, distorting glass. When they approach me, they see only my surroundings, themselves or figments of their imagination. Indeed, everything and anything except me. Nor is my invisibility exactly a matter of biochemical accident to my epidermis. That invisibility to which I refer occurs because of a peculiar disposition of the eyes of those with whom I come in contact, a matter of the construction of their inner eyes, those eyes with which they look through their physical eyes upon reality. I am not complaining, nor am I protesting either. It is sometimes advantageous to be unseen, although it is most often rather wearing on the nerves.
So you mentioned to me that you read this all the time, at least once a year.
Yes,
what,
the prologue.
What keeps drawing you back to it?
Gosh, the prologue. Yes, I do read it about once a year. In terms of style or just the prologue itself? I mean, the prologue itself is... it's such a declaration of someone who is unseen, and they are despondent, but also pretty facetious about kind of their state and how others see them, which I guess is me in a lot of ways, and it's also how I felt being one of the few people of color in my educational life for the first 18 years of my life. And even those first two paragraphs, that thought of, he does explain, like, I'm not truly invisible. This is not H.G. Wells, Invisible Man. But he does break down that it's in their inner mind, or how people don't see him as a human, basically. And that when you live your life like that, you might just kind of live in the margins. But when you try not to live in the margins, you get bumped along.
It's an incredibly evocative opening, in that from the beginning we're introduced to someone who is wry and clever and extremely mercurial. He moves from mood to mood, and this is a guy that you know from the page one is going to take you on a ride. He's clever, and he knows a lot of stuff. He's also going to very quickly draw you into his confidence. It's a funny book from the standpoint of point of view. At the very end of the novel, when we've come full circle and we're back with the narrator talking directly to the reader, he talks about writing what he's been writing down and not sure what he's trying to do or to whom he's addressing it. Again, it's kind of a very bookish thing to do. It's that out of that tradition of, we've got to give some reason why this novel is now in our hands.
Right.
And there's not really a good reason for it to be in your hands. But yeah, one of the things that I love about this introduction is it's sort of like a very slow focus on what's happening. You know, if someone were able to pick up this book unknowing and know nothing about who Ralph Ellison was or what this book was about, it's not going to be until many pages in that it gives you a hint that this is this story of an African-American man in the middle of the 20th century. But it is slowly drawing that focus in. And the mention of being invisible and saying it's not an accident of epidermis is, of course, you know, redolent of issues of race. And it's so clever and so slow to build, and I guess the narrative voice feels both inviting and disquieting to me.
That is perfect. In fact, when rereading it, the narrator in the middle of the book had mentioned just by himself, or in one moment right after I think Todd Clifton dies, that he was feeling a feverish isolation. And I'm like, that's kind of the whole book. He can be described as a feverish isolation, because he feels alone, but he's in the middle of a lot of shit, I can swear on this.
Well, let's talk a little bit here about the about this as a book for young readers. I unfortunately didn't have the chance to read this in high school. I wish I did, because I think it is I actually think it's an excellent book to read at that age, in you know, and especially looking back on my white little town, it would have done us some good to read something that was so completely divorced from our experience. But what do you think about it as, obviously it changed your life.
Yeah, please read in high school, everyone. Or like, if you're a teacher, please assign it. In terms of the trajectory, I think I'm glad that it was something I read my senior year. I think like freshman, this is like pretty intense. And like you said, it not only makes references like deep cut Greek mythology and like Moby Dick, I think that even just, I think that, yeah, these things like in terms of African-American literature, I wish we had read Native Son, because I think that would have given me another perspective of what Ellison was riffing on, but other, you know, works earlier, like Their Eyes Were Watching God, even like the plays of August Wilson, like start them off with like a foundation, because Ralph Ellison, quite jazz-like, riffs on so much.
And you were mentioning also that you are already casting the movie version.
Well, I buried the lead. I'm going to quickly shout out. I mainly reread this through Audible, and I listened to Joe Morton's recounting of Invisible Man, which, you know, he is the actor from Brother from Another Planet and Olivia Pope's dad on Scandal. I want him to be in the movie, too. Maybe he'll be Barbie the Reverend. I don't know. But, yeah, casting it, ugh, I wish the narrator could be Andre Holland from 15 years ago, but now Andre Holland is almost 40, so that's not going to be cute. I would love Trevante Rhodes to be Todd Clifton. I even, like, when I was listening to the Sybil part, for some reason I was picturing Emma Stone. I don't know, Emma. I'm sorry. I think she'd have fun with it. What was I going to say, if anyone else? Oh, yeah, I guess the only young person I was like, could maybe do it, who would be the narrator, if you've watched The Get Down, would be Justice Smith as the narrator, or ever seen him perform at all.
Well, do you think anyone can ever film this, though? I mean,
it's been up there with like unfilmable, like The Sandman, sorta, that people have been trying to make that a thing, and like Confederacy of Dunces, you know. There has been the advent of, like, I would feel like the narrator, he's a bit of a dick, even though I love him. And so, like, there's, like, a bit of an anti-hero streak in him, but I think as a society, we're burnt out on that. So it's a fine, I don't know, it's a fine line, if that makes sense. Like, I don't know how to make him, likable, but then honest with what, like, how sour he is.
On the other hand, there's such a taste right now for that mid-century historical drama, you know?
Yeah.
Like Mad Men, obviously, but even things like Hidden Figures.
Yeah.
I think that it might be time to re-examine the 1950s with a black story.
I think I'm very protective of Invisible Man, a little childlike, like, especially if it's someone who's not me doing it. And I'm like, oh, who did you cast? Like, you're doing what? You know, and then there's like a Pharrell Williams song as like the theme song. And you're like, I guess. So I'm a little protective. I'm a little overprotective. So this has been owner of the Ralph Ellison Estate, Jane Dempsey.
Thanks once again to Jane Dempsey for co-hosting. If you'd like to send me email, please do so at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. You can also join us in the Facebook group. Just search for Sophomore Lit. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts at theincomparable.com. I'll see you next time, and remember, everything is on the final.